This is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll chat about the upcoming Always for Pleasure Festival. Then Jessica Rosegard returns with Richard Campanella to discuss his Cityscapes column for NOLA.com, The Times-Picayune. And America Recycles Day is right around the corner. We'll talk about that and the reopening of the Green Project. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. Stay with us. The third annual Always for Pleasure Festival is a celebration combining elements of film and music. The weekend of events is right around the corner, and joining me now to talk all about it is Executive Director of Court 13 Arts, Casey Coleman, and Miriam Arkin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. An absolute pleasure to be here.
Casey, tell us about Court 13 Arts.
Well, Court 13 Arts is a local artist support nonprofit that spun out of a sort of a large filmmaking collective called Court 13 that has existed in some form or fashion for the better part of 10 years. We were a group of filmmakers that were working on various projects. Specifically, Ben Zeitlin's films were a big part of the collective. And that sort of culminated with Beasts of the Southern Wild. And through Ben's filmmaking process, he often works with artists, fine artists, people that don't typically work in film, non-actors, what have you. And we always sort of wanted to figure out a way to continue to support those artists and just sort of community people outside of any individual film project. So Court 13 Arts was kind of born out of that. We wanted to create a permanent infrastructure to have programming that could support people independent of any film projects. So we created the 501c3 2 years ago. Have been throwing the festival. This is the third festival, and have kind of a year-round slate of programming, including the festival, artist residencies, things like that.
So Core 13 Arts has been around for 2 years, and I understand that you guys have a new facility. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure, yeah. One of the kind of problems we identified with our filmmaking was that we would develop these beautiful spaces, and there would be all this energy that would form with art making in these spaces, but when the film would wrap, we would ultimately have to kind of tear it all down and leave. And so that energy would kind of dissipate. So we decided that we needed to buy a building. So we launched a pretty big fundraiser a couple years ago, purchased a 25,000 square foot property on Franklin Avenue, which is now the home and headquarters for all of our year-round programming.
That's a lot of space.
It's a lot of space, for sure. And we're actively figuring out how to fill that space. We're working on developing community workshop space for people to come in and use the tools, things like that. But at the moment, we have our first artist in residency program happening there. And then the festival is going to use sort of every nook and cranny of the whole space this year. So
Miriam, you're the co-coordinator of this festival. First, before we dig into what to expect, could you tell us how this festival got started?
Absolutely. Well, Always for Pleasure is named after the documentary by Les Blank, quite well known, all about New Orleans. And essentially, it's always trying to keep with that theme of the way that these artistic efforts in New Orleans can feel so effortless and can feel so founded in community and enthusiasm. So we decided that there must be a way to kind of experience art across disciplines and kind of get into working on and working within arts and various different disciplines in ways that feel kind of organic and that allow everyone to participate. So it's allowing artists to display art in ways that they want. It's allowing films to be displayed in ways that they don't typically. So it's kind of a let's do something a little bit off the beaten, but let's also make sure that we have all kinds of participants and make everybody feel a part of it.
Are these artists sought after, or is there a registration process for them to be incorporated in the festival?
It's a bit of a mix. So for the artists in residence, we did put out a call for people to submit project ideas, and we selected artists. So we have three who are participating. And for the films, we had kind of a process of selecting locally produced short projects. We're going to be featuring some NOCA student films, things like that. And then we also tried to go out to collaborators from Court 13's history and past. So for instance, Jonas Carpignano's Ashiambra is going to be screened at the Orpheum, and that is kind of coming out of a collaboration. He came down to work on Beasts of the Southern Wild and kind of has gone on to work on all kinds of different film projects and now has made his own. So that's going to be pretty exciting.
Now, Casey, Miriam just mentioned a screening at the Orpheum Theater. Could you tell us about that partnership?
you know, we have a slate of a couple of nights of short film programs at our building that's going to be fun warehouse style screenings. In addition to that, we knew we wanted to show these feature films, Achiambra and Brimstone and Glory, which is both are world premieres, at least North American premieres, I guess. And we kind of wanted to create a more sort of appropriate, massive, epic cinematic experience than we could provide in our building. So we reached out to the Orpheum. They were incredibly willing to partner with us. It's kind of like the best room in the city for seeing a film. I mean, it's just like jaw-dropping when you walk in there. And both of the films, you know, both of those films sort of deserve that level of grandeur and spectacle. And so, yeah, the Tuesday the 21st, we're going to be premiering both of those films at the Orpheum.
What sets this festival apart from all the other festivals in New Orleans?
I think that what the goal of Court 13 broadly and Always for Pleasure specifically is we're trying to, you know, remove art or take art into a different context. So displaying, exhibiting, bringing audiences in to see art that's not in a typical gallery or white wall context. And we want to do the same with our film exhibition. The idea is that we want to create cinematic experiences that are different than you would typically get at a normal cinema, and to allow audiences to like have these like big sort of crazy fun cinema experiences. And an example of that, Brimstone and Glory, which is premiering at the Orpheum on the 21st of November, is a documentary about this like totally mad fireworks festival in Mexico that was the kind of the next film after Beasts of the Southern Wild that Court 13 produced. In the process of making that documentary, we met a crew of guys in Mexico that make these beautiful, massive bowl sculptures that they explode with fireworks. So we've been able to fly them up. They're making a bowl for our festival that, unfortunately, we are not going to be able to explode. City permitting people, if you're listening, know that we're not going to be using any pyro at the festival. So that's an example of, like, this film is going to be showing at the Orpheum. It's a feast for the senses. It's crazy explosions, sound extravaganza. And we brought up these artists from Mexico that are going to be making art that's reminiscent to what you'll be seeing on the screen. So that's just an example of, like, how we're trying to create an experience that's different than you will get at any other film or music festival in the city.
Nice. Now, this celebration takes over an entire weekend. So, Miriam, tell us what festival goers can expect.
Okay, there's going to be an entire weekend's worth of fun. And essentially, what we want to encourage people to do is kind of come and just get caught up in the mix. So it's going to have a little bit of everything for everyone. So if you're a cinema enthusiast, there's going to be interesting cinema to see. If you're an arts enthusiast, there's going to be kind of interesting and explorative art to both look at and, in certain cases, participate in. If you like to eat good food, there's going to be good food. And certainly if you like to drink drinks while you do all those things, you can do that too. So when they come, it's essentially about kind of immersing yourself in the experience of all these different kind of artistic mediums coming together in one space, interacting with each other, and most especially kind of cultivating a really fun space for audiences in New Orleans to come and see all this stuff in one place. So I think that's about the expectations. Casey, do you have any thoughts?
We have the world's, as far as we know, the world's only known karaoke parade, which we have done several, we've executed several times, and this year is going to be special for a number of reasons. We have, kind of don't want to give away the secret, but we have the words you're going to be reading are going to be presented in an extremely special way. But we're going to parade through the neighborhood, karaoke singers on a float, reading the words, singing to the heavens, viewing the skyline, having a beautiful ecstatic experience. We like to present the karaoke for the people, definitely.
I mean, you're definitely getting it done. Of course, this celebration is putting together film and music. Miriam, any chance that any of the directors of these films will be at the Always for Pleasure Festival next weekend?
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of in, again, highlighting how we want to participate on levels big and small. So some of the directors will be, for instance, the NOCA film students, and they will be in attendance to show their films on Saturday afternoon. So that's going to be kind of a fun opportunity for them to kind of get to show their work that they've just been working on this whole fall semester. And then on Tuesday night at the Orpheum, we will most certainly have Jonas Carpignano, who is the director of Achiambra, and Viktor Yakovlevsky, who is the director of Brimstone and Glory, in attendance. And we will be talking to them about the films that they've made.
I'm glad that you mentioned Tuesday, because you guys are actually doing a screening that's a little separate from the Always for Pleasure Festival. Casey, could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so there's a full weekend of events happening at our new headquarters, which is located at 2801 Franklin Avenue. That's going to be Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And we're actually doing a BYO with your very own Lane, Captain Levinson, on the Friday night, among other things. And there will be short film programs happening at the space. And then the following week, we're going to be doing the film screenings at the Orpheum. So if you go to the website, alwaysforpleasure.org, you can see the full schedule of events there.
Yeah, and I would like to add, in terms of other film screenings where folks will be in attendance, we are also on Friday night after BYO with the glorious Lane Captain Levinson. We're going to be doing a series of shorts from the Third Horizon Film Festival out of Miami, which is really exciting because it features a bunch of Caribbean films and filmmakers. So we'll be having Jason Jeffers, who's the director of that festival, to kind of program and talk about those shorts. So another really exciting series of kind of film programming events to come and see.
Nice. That was Miriam Arkin, the co-coordinator of the Always for Pleasure Festival, and Casey Coleman, executive director for Court 13 Arts. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so very much.
The annual Always for Pleasure Festival is scheduled for November 16th through 21st at their new facility at 2801 Franklin Avenue. For more information, visit alwaysforpleasure.org. Time for our monthly conversation with Richard Campanella to discuss his Cityscapes column for NOLA.com, The Times-Picayune. Here's WWNO's Jessica Rosegard.
Sitting here with Richard Campanella, professor of geography at the Tulane School of Architecture, we're here to talk about the latest column in NOLA.com, The Times-Picayune, The What Ifs of History and Geography. Richard, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Take us back for people who may have missed the previous columns or our previous interviews. And just briefly explain to me how we got to this column. We've been talking about the annexation of various parts of land around the city to finally become New Orleans, right?
Since June, I've devoted my Cityscapes columns to the four annexations that give us Orleans Parish and New Orleans' current incorporated footprint. In this current Cityscapes, what I contemplate is what would New Orleans look like had these never occurred?
What benefit do we get from kind of having this question in this conversation?
The what ifs of history are valuable conversations to have because they serve as a reminder that history is filled with contingency. There was no inevitability here. There was no meant to be here. And what we have today may or may not be an enlightened ideal circumstance. Decisions were made. And people made them, and ugly stuff happened, and power was exerted, and voices were quashed. Things could have played out differently. I use that sort of notion that both history and geography are both not inevitable and filled with decision makers and contingency plans to look back on how things could have played out had the annexations not occurred.
To narrate us through this example, you use a comparison of our sister city up the river, St. Louis.
Another former French colony on the Mississippi, a major riverine port, the gateway to the west. The similarities are quite striking with, of course, many exceptions, but one that comes to light in this particular study is the fact that equivalent annexations did not occur in St. Louis. The actual municipal limits of the city of St. Louis extend about 5 miles from the Mississippi River straight west. New Orleans, before the 1852 annexation, was about 6 miles along the river. So they were fairly comparable in size. Now, St. Louis never annexes anything across the river, which, by the way, is in the state of Illinois, mm-hmm. nor does it annex these communities to the west, which become their own incorporated areas. So if you look at Washington University, it's a pretty good equivalent of our Tulane University in that it is in the kind of leafy garden suburbs on the western edge, but it is not within the city of St. Louis. It's closer to two other municipalities. One is called Clayton and the other is called University City. The site where Tulane and Loyola are today, up until 1870, were their own city, Jefferson. And so I explored Clayton as a prototype or an exemplar of what Jefferson City might have looked like had it never been annexed. And Clayton has a CBD. It has a little rise of high rises.
You mentioned the parks and the gardens in Audubon Park and how that would have been former
Jefferson City.
Jefferson City. You have that comparison as well with St. Louis in your article. Tell me a bit about that.
There's a number of really striking parallels. Our city park and botanical gardens is their Tower Grove Park, which also has a botanical gardens. Our Audubon Park and Zoo is their Forest Park, which also has a zoo. Our Audubon Place and our number of private residential streets, so-called residential parks, was an idea originally formulated in the 1860s by a St. Louis-based engineer and surveyor by the name of Julius Pitzman. And he worked with the Robinson Company based out of St. Louis to export this idea to other southern cities to create Rosa Park in 1891, Audubon Place in 1894. So it's really a St. Louis export. You go a little farther, and St. Louis used to have a quote-unquote French Quarter. And they made the decision to demolish it in favor of what is now the Gateway Arch Park. Now, folks in St. Louis uphold their Solar District as kind of roughly the equivalent of the way we uphold the French Quarter as our showcase historic neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
It has a Solard market, much like we have the French market. And starting in 1980, they now have an annual Mardi Gras. So the parallels are really striking. If you go a little farther, you'll also see in some of the smaller Mississippi River communities on the outskirts of St. Louis, St. Genevieve, and going south along the river, you have some early 18th and 19th century Creole architecture, mm-hmm. which are dead ringers for some of our 18th century housing stocks, such as the Lombard House, the Bitat House, the old Spanish Custom House, mm-hmm. steep-hipped roofs, galleries, raised construction. And you also see the French long line cadastral system there.
Both obviously large cities along the same river, but different things going on.
The major geographical distinction here is that whereas St. Louis was an interior city, New Orleans was the nexus between hinterland and foreland. It is both a river port and a seaport. And so in addition to all of the cultural groups coming downriver, as well as the Native Americans, New Orleans gets that very diverse group coming in from the greater Atlantic system, the Gulf, the Caribbean Basin, the shores of Latin America and West Africa, the Mediterranean, and Europe. This is what one of the great distinctions that sets New Orleans apart in so many ways and leads many people to grasp for that word, uniqueness.
You know, I thought this was a really interesting, fascinating article and lovely to think about and consider our sister city up the river. Richard Campanella, thanks again.
Richard Campanella is a professor of geography at the Tulane School of Architecture. His Cityscapes column can be found every month on NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune.
Good morning, evening.
November 15th is America Recycles Day. It's a day to celebrate recycling and the culture of reuse. Here in New Orleans, the Green Project is reopening on that exact same day. Joining me now to talk more about the Green Project is Executive Director Catherine Crowell. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Of course. Go ahead and tell us a bit more about the Green Project.
So the Green Project's been around for 23 years. We were started in 1994 in the Mid-City neighborhood. One of our founder, Linda Stone, noticed some of her neighbors were pouring paint on the storm drain, which, of course, many people still don't know goes directly to Lake Pontchartrain.
Okay.
So from that, we started a paint recycling program. At first, it was just neighbors exchanging paint. And from there, we learned how to actually recycle the paint. So all of us have a gallon of paint underneath our sink in our sheds, and we are able to take that paint, process it into new usable paint that we sell in our store. We're the only one in the Gulf South that does it, and we take in about 40,000 gallons every year.
That's a lot of paint.
It is a lot of paint.
So tell us a bit more about other reusable items that you guys get.
So beyond the paint, we take in pretty much every type of building and construction material. So from doors to trim to drywall to doorknobs, anything you can imagine. And we are doing pickups and drop-offs Monday through Saturday, 9 to 4. And each day we're taking in about 6 tons of materials every single day.
Now, can you give us just a few examples of how folks are reusing these items?
So most people know us for our store. When they need to replace their bedroom door, they'll come in to find a new door. But what we are trying to promote is this culture of creative reuse. So what is a door? A door, of course, is a door, but You know, in our offices, we actually, all our office desks are made out of doors that we've reused because it's all lumber that came from a tree. So really getting people to think differently about what materials are.
And again, America Recycles Day is November 15th. And with so many harmful chemicals and greenhouse gases being released, why is it so critical for Americans to recycle these days?
Recycling has a lot of benefits. Of course, it is an affordable way to bring materials for those that can't afford it. It reduces our need on oil, which is a big issue right now. A lot of the plastic and the things that we find in new materials are petroleum-based. So using these materials limits our need on these natural resources. And because it's New Orleans and everything's creative and funky here, this culture of creative reuse really promotes that culture we have here in the city.
Mm-hmm. Now, your team at the Green Project will be celebrating its reopening on next week. What's so different this time around?
So we are partnering with our neighbors at the Preservation Resource Center, and we are gaining about 10,000 square feet of additional store space. Even though we're taking about 6 tons of materials a day, there are still materials that we were not able to take. So this additional space allows us to take even more materials to recycle and reuse. And then for our community, it gives us that much more space to find additional materials. We're also launching our workshop series. So we've been having workshops for many, many years, but this year we're adding a lot more technical skills. So how to do the home repair yourself when you're finding that door for your bedroom, or how to make these desks out of the doors like we have in our office.
The reopening will include some workshops and also a fair. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
In honor of America Recycles Day, we are having an all-day recycling fair. So we have about a dozen other nonprofits joining us. So, of course, we'll be taking in building materials and paint like we usually do, but we are expanding to all other types of recycling materials. So we are taking in unwanted books that the Symphony Book Fair will have for their spring event. We'll be recycling cork from wine bottles. We'll be taking in bed sheets, t-shirts, things that normally couldn't go to Goodwill. We can actually make that into paint rags for other housing nonprofits as well. So we encourage people to come and recycle all their materials and really just learn how you can extend the life of these materials that can be have many more uses and don't need to end up in the landfill.
And will you guys be teaching folks how to reuse these items at the workshops?
Yes, we will. The workshop I'm most excited about is we're going to be doing a Thanksgiving centerpiece with reuse materials. So it's a really great way to wow your Thanksgiving guests. Come learn with us. We'll have a table set up about how you can make this Thanksgiving centerpiece as well.
For folks unable to join you guys on America Recycles Day, will you have any other workshops during the holiday season?
Well, those that work, we are having a special happy hour event in conjunction with Life City. So that's 5:30 to 7:30. We're going to be hosting a happy hour event. So we are asking people to join us for free cocktails, snacks. The event's going to be 100% recyclable and compostable. And all the snacks and drinks are going to be creative, reuse, and construction themed.
Okay. And what about the month of December?
So in addition to the happy hour event, the following Saturday on the 18th, we're going to be having a workshop about how to build your own nightstand. And then in December, we're having 2 workshops about how to make an eco-conscious Christmas gift for your family and friends.
Wow, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
That was Catherine Crowell, Executive Director for The Green Project. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
The Green Project's reopening is on America Recycles Day, November 15th. For more information, visit thegreenproject.org. And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Follow me on Twitter at Miss Janae Pierre and feel free to tweet comments or questions. Would you like to suggest a guest or topic? Send an email to Janae at WWNO.org. That's J-A-N-A-E at WWNO.org. Visit our website to check out previous shows and be sure to catch us next week right here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux-Houma. Thanks for joining us.